Today's broadcast was originally recorded on November 7th, 2024.
Here's what we know. We're going to come out of this election and we're going to make all kind of pronouncements about what this country is and what this world is. And the truth is, we're not really going to know shit. And we're going to make it seem like this is the finality of our civilization and this and thing. We're all going to have to wake up tomorrow morning and work like hell to move the world to the place that we prefer it to be. But this isn't the end. I promise you, this is not the end. And we have to regroup and we have to continue to fight and continue to work day in and day out to create the better society for our children, for this world, for this country that we know is possible.
Okay, John. I'm in.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
It is not.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV. Out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN. Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. In Seattle on KODX. Richmond, Virginia's WRWK. Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR. Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR. And Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast-to-coast and around the globe every day on the internets and the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Fine affiliates all. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from BradBlog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. I'm already exhausted, Desi Doyen. It's been that kind of week.
Yep, and it's not going to get any better.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. Coming up on today's broadcast, maybe it'll get better. Among other things, Joe Biden addresses the nation in his first public remarks since Donald Trump's apparently resounding defeat of Kamala Harris this week. We've got some freshly breaking news on another call made by AP for an important U.S. Senate seat and for insight on one of the brighter spots from this week's otherwise pretty grim election results. We will be joined by Capitol Hill reporter Alice Olstein shortly. But I do need to start somewhat locally here for the moment with some news out of Los Angeles today, as if to remind us of the greatly increased threat that humanity is now confronting, along with the return by Donald Trump to the White House. Donald Trump, a man who has repeatedly described climate change as a hoax. Well, right on cue, along with a very unusual late season hurricane now spinning down in the Gulf of Mexico. Yes, yet another one. Here in Southern California, a fast-moving wildfire that exploded right as we were getting off the air yesterday, fueled by heavy winds and very dry conditions. That fire is now tearing through a community northwest of Los Angeles for a second day on Thursday after destroying dozens of homes and forcing thousands of residents to flee when it blew up in size in just a few hours beginning on Wednesday, according to the LA Times. The blaze is being called the Mountain Fire, and it has prompted evacuation orders Wednesday for more than 10,000 people, as it reportedly threatens some 3,500 structures in suburban communities, ranches, and agricultural areas around Camarillo, California. That's in Ventura County. And all of that, according to Governor Gavin Newsom. The fire is already said to have scorched more than 14,000 acres and was at 0% containment as of Thursday afternoon. That as fierce seasonal winds drove the blaze down tinder-dry hillsides into ranches and homes, according to authorities. Homes and mansions, I should note, in Camarillo have been set ablaze by embers that were blown 2 miles from the fire front, according to Ventura County fire officials. Quote, "It's like trying to put out a blowtorch with a squirt gun," said Department Captain Tony McHale of the Ventura County Fire Department of the fire, which began in a hillside canyon on Wednesday before it was tore west thanks to these Santa Ana winds that we have blowing in to Los Angeles, these hot, dry winds that come in this time of year. The fire is also fueled by abundant grass and scrub with wind gusts up to 80 miles per hour.
That's like almost a hurricane.
Yeah,
gust.
I know. Climate scientists say warming temperatures have created wet winters that allow California's coastal chaparral, that's the trees and shrubs and bushes that allows that to thrive. Record high temperatures this summer subsequently have turned hillsides into unlit bonfires with all of that fuel available. Several civilians were injured and a significant number of homes, businesses, and other structures destroyed, according to Captain McHale, adding that it was too dangerous to even enter the area to even assess damage as of Thursday afternoon. Schools in Ventura County were closed throughout through Friday because of the fires, according to officials. The fire expanded in size on Wednesday, following powerful winds coming into contact with very dry air. Southern California Edison began shutting off power to customers in areas where its equipment was considered at high risk of sparking a wildfire. Well, that's a good idea. The U.S. is experiencing a very strong wildfire season this year, with 8.1 million acres burned to date. That compared with an annual full-year average of around 7 million acres over the past decade. California wildfires have so far this year burned more than 3 times as much land as last year at this time. More on that and Hurricane Rafael, which has spun up in the Gulf, in Desi Doyen's latest Green News report a little bit later this hour.
Yeah, and you know, and I just want to add that the high temperatures are part of what suck the moisture out of all of this vegetation that has grown up, and that's part of the multiple factors that cause these incredible wildfires.
And of course, it all comes amid Donald Trump's recent threats to cut off disaster aid to us here in California, to the firefighting efforts and disaster aid to the residents here. If Governor Gavin Newsom does not toe the line with whatever state policies that Donald Trump wants him to carry out. Well, on Thursday morning, Newsom suggested he would not be intimidated by the incoming president, announcing on Twitter that he has called an emergency special state legislative session, quote, "to protect our state against any unlawful actions by the incoming Trump administration." I'm not sure. I've lived in California for 20, 30 years at this point. I'm not sure I ever remember the governor calling a special session, certainly not for something like this. The session will begin December 2nd. It will, quote, "focus on bolstering California legal resources to protect civil rights, reproductive freedom, climate action, and immigrant families," Newsom's office said. In his Twitter post, which linked to an LA Times story about the plans, Newsom said, quote, "California is ready to fight, whether it be our fundamental civil rights, reproductive freedoms, or climate action. We refuse to turn back the clock and allow our values and laws to be attacked." During Trump's first term in office, his administration was sued by state attorneys general nearly 140 times That's about twice the levels of the previous administrations of Barack Obama and George W. Bush. And as we learned in recent weeks, Trump already had attempted to hold up wildfire disaster relief to California during his first administration. He only relented after his aides pointed out that, yeah, the state of California, so-called Blue California, actually has more Republican voters than any other state in the union. Oh, okay. I guess I'll help him with disaster aid in that case.
Yeah, and he also withheld it from several other states like Utah and Washington, and they had to wait until Biden came into office to get it.
Anyone he doesn't like for whatever reason there is. So good on Newsom for standing up here in advance to push back against whatever may be coming. More news, more breaking news as we go to air today. AP has made another grim call in this year's elections in another U.S. Senate race, this one in Pennsylvania, with a Republican unseating a longtime Democratic Senate stalwart. Republican David McCormick has won Pennsylvania's pivotal U.S. Senate seat as the former CEO of the world's largest hedge fund. He's also a cryptocurrency millionaire or billionaire. I don't know.
Oh, great.
He reportedly defeated three-term Democratic Senator Bob Casey. Kind of stunning. That battleground state contest now pads Republicans' majority status in the Senate, which they had wrested from Democratic control this week. McCormick drew on contacts from across the worlds of government, politics, and finance to secure backing for his campaign after he was CEO of the world's largest hedge fund and served at the highest levels of former President George W. Bush's administration. He also benefited from tens of millions of dollars in campaign cash from billionaires and other allies from across the worlds of hedge funds and securities trading. Beating Casey is, as AP reports, earth-shaking for Pennsylvania's Democratic establishment. Casey is the namesake of a former two-term governor and Pennsylvania's longest-serving Democrat ever in the U.S. Senate. Until Tuesday, Casey had won six statewide general elections going all the way back to 1996.
And it was a very tight race.
It was McCormick's second time running. This time with a clear primary and former President Donald Trump's former and future, Trump's endorsement after he had lost narrowly to the Trump-endorsed Dr. Mehmet Oz TV doctor back in 2022 in an expensive seven-way GOP primary. A longtime abortion opponent, McCormick insisted during the campaign that he would oppose a federal ban on abortion and that he would leave in place Pennsylvania's law that allows an abortion up to the 24th week of gestation. But as I will discuss with my guest shortly, such promises may not mean much in the upcoming administration when it comes to abortion. McCormick also faced accusations, first in 2022's GOP primary and then again by Casey, that he was a rich carpetbagger from Connecticut, from its ritzy Gold Coast, that he was trying to buy a Senate seat, as well he was. And that is where he lived until he ran for Senate the first time in 22. And while he bought a house in Pittsburgh, he also maintained his massive home in Connecticut until earlier this year. That call now guarantees that Republicans will have 53 seats in the majority of the U.S. Senate next year, with two races now in Arizona and Nevada still uncalled at this hour by AP. And finally, before we take a break and get to my guest today, President Joe Biden addressed the nation from the Rose Garden in his first public remarks since the election on Thursday, and he vowed a peaceful transfer of power in the nation's capital on January 20th of next year, something that presidents did not used to have to do. It was sort of, you know, taken for granted until, well, you know who and you know what. The president, a longtime champion of democracy, told Americans that the U.S. election system is fair and that win or lose, democracy always prevails, he said. while also encouraging Kamala Harris supporters not to lose hope, telling them that while, quote, setbacks are unavoidable, giving up is unforgivable.
For over 200 years, America has carried on the greatest experiment in self-government in the history of the world. And that's not hyperbole, that's a fact. We're the people. The people vote and choose their own leaders, and they do it peacefully. And we're in a democracy. The will of the people always prevails. Yesterday, I spoke with President-elect Trump to congratulate him on his victory. And I assured him that I'd direct my entire administration to work with his team to ensure a peaceful and orderly transition. That's what the American people deserve. Yesterday, I also spoke with Vice President Harris. She's been a partner and a public servant. She ran an inspiring campaign, and everyone got to see something that I learned early on to respect so much, her character. She has a backbone like a ramrod. She has great character, true character. She gave her whole heart and effort, and she and her entire team should be proud of the campaign they ran. You know, the struggle for the soul of America, since our very founding, has always been an ongoing debate and still vital today. I know for some people, it's a time for victory, to state the obvious. For others, it's a time of loss. Campaigns are contests of competing visions. The country chooses one or the other. We accept the choice the country made. I've said many times, you can't love your country only when you win. You can't love your neighbor only when you agree. Something that I hope we can do, no matter who you voted for, is see each other not as adversaries, but as fellow Americans. Bring down the temperature. I also hope we can lay to rest the question about the integrity of the American electoral system. It is honest, it is fair, and it is transparent. And it can be trusted, win or lose. I also hope we can restore the respect for all our election workers who busted their necks and took risks at the outset. We should thank them. Thank them for staffing voting sites, counting the votes, and protecting the very integrity of the election. Many of them are volunteers who do it simply out of love for their country. And as they did their duty as citizens, I will do my duty as president. I'll fulfill my oath, and I will honor the Constitution. On January 20th, we'll have a peaceful transfer of power here in America. To all our incredible staff, supporters, cabinet members, all the people who have been hanging out with me for the last 4 years, God love you, as my mother would say, thank you so much. You put so much into the past 4 years. I know it's a difficult time. You're hurting. I hear you and I see you. But don't forget. Don't forget all that we accomplished. It's been a historic presidency. Not because I'm president, because what we've done, what you've done. A presidency for all Americans. Much of the work we've done is already being felt by the American people, but the vast majority of it will not be felt. We felt over the next 10 years. We have legislation we passed that's just only now just really kicking in. We're going to see over $1 trillion worth of infrastructure work done, changing people's lives in rural communities and communities that are in real difficulty, because it takes time to get it done. And so much more, it's going to take time, but it's there. The road ahead is clear, assuming we sustain it. There's so much we can get done and will get done based on the way the legislation was passed. And it's truly historic. You know, we're leaving behind the strongest economy in the world. I know people are still hurting, but things are changing rapidly. Together, we've changed America for the better. Now we have 74 days to finish the term, our term. Let's make every day count. That's the responsibility we have to the American people. Look, folks, you all know it in your lives. Setbacks are unavoidable, but giving up is unforgivable. Setbacks are unavoidable, but giving up is unforgivable. We all get knocked down. But the measure of our character, as my dad would say, is how quickly we get back up. Remember, a defeat does not mean we are defeated. We lost this battle. The America of your dreams is calling for you to get back up. That's the story of America for over 240 years and counting. It's a story for all of us, not just some of us. The American experiment endures. We're going to be okay, but we need to stay engaged. We need to keep going. And above all, we need to keep the faith. I'm so proud to have worked with all of you. I really mean it. I sincerely mean it. God bless you all. God bless America. And may God protect our troops. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
President Biden on Thursday in the Rose Garden speaking to White House staff and supporters. That guy's pretty good, by the way. Maybe Democrats should have put him up for president this year. I don't know. He sounded good to me. By the way, we don't simply trust elections. We oversee them. Wanted to correct that. Other than that, I pretty much agree with everything he had to say.
Yeah, keep the faith, keep going.
I'm also grateful that he, as Kamala Harris did on Wednesday in her concession speech, thanked poll workers for what they do under impossible and, once again this year, dangerous conditions, thanks to threats of violence from Trump supporters on Election Day and actual bomb threats to dozens of Democratic-leaning polling places around the country said to have originated via, Trump's allies in Russia. All right, let's take a quick break here, and we will be joined by Politico's Alice Olstein with insight on one of the brighter spots for progressives this week at the polls, the fight for abortion rights. That's straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast.
You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, you might find.
Yep. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Despite the ominous election news this week, with Donald Trump retaking the White House and Republicans winning majority control of the U.S. Senate, and very possibly holding on to their current slim majority in the U.S. House, there were some bright spots on the ballot this week. One of them was in the state fights for reproductive freedoms around the country, as measures to expand or protect access were on the ballot in some 10 different states following the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court Republican majority ruling that overturned Roe v. Wade in their Dobbs decision back in 2022. Well, seven of those 10 states appear to have passed ballot measures this week to expand or enshrine the right to abortion, including Arizona, Colorado, Maryland, Nevada, and New York, and voters in even Republican strongholds like Montana and my old home state of Missouri. They became the first state since Dobbs to overturn a near total ban on the procedure, even as the state otherwise went to Donald Trump by nearly 20 points. Yes, it went to the guy whose anti-abortion U.S. Supreme Court justices took away the right in the first place. At the same time, however, abortion rights ballot measures failed in three states, in Nebraska, South Dakota, and Florida, even as it garnered 57% support from voters in Florida, where it requires 60% for passage of constitutional ballot measures, and where it faced some very strong-arm tactics from Governor Ron DeSantis and his administration. Either way, those losses were the very first for such measures since the Supreme Court overturned Roe, with reproductive rights activists winning really everywhere, even in deep states, at least until this week. As Alice Miranda Olstein reports for Politico, after Tuesday's elections, losses in GOP-controlled states highlighted the left's struggle to keep voters focused on the issue, as well as the right's evolving strategies to kneecap the ballot measure process itself. And, she notes, abortion opponents, meanwhile, have vowed to keep fighting initiatives that have already passed, with plans to file legal challenges and, should those fail, pursue additional ballot measures to wind back the clock. But overall, at least for now, mostly good news for proponents of abortion rights and freedoms on this front, I think, on Tuesday, in one of the few bright spots for progressives in this year's elections. We're joined now by Alice Miranda Olstein, a healthcare reporter for Politico Pro on the Capitol Hill beat, who for many years before had covered federal politics and policy for Talking Points Memo, which is where we got to know her. Alice, it has been a while, but welcome back to the broadcast.
Thanks so much.
So let's start with the losses this week, since that is almost a bigger story in some ways, given the success of these measures pretty much everywhere since the Dobbs ruling in 22. First, I've seen a lot of outlets reporting that the abortion rights amendment in Florida, Amendment 4, I believe, reports on it failing, which is true, but it failed with 57% majority in favor, just 43 opposed, which would be a huge win almost anywhere else. But because Florida requires 60% plus one for passage of constitutional measures, it failed. Isn't that exactly why Ohio Republicans last year tried but failed to change their threshold for passage of constitutional amendments to on the ballot to 60%?
That's right. Several states have actually tried to raise the thresholds to 60%. And some of the Republican officials leading those efforts, some of them very openly said it was intended to make it harder to pass something on abortion rights specifically, although they are also, you know, have for years fought efforts to expand Medicaid, raise the minimum wage, and do other progressive things via ballot initiative. What I think is, I agree with you that there was a lot of sort of misleading reporting about Florida. I saw a lot of articles start with, you know, the words voters reject, blah, blah, blah,
exactly.
Which you can't really accurately say voters reject
right.
When it's 57% in favor. You could say the effort fell short or something like that. And another inaccuracy I have been seeing a lot is people speculating that Florida changed its threshold to 60% specifically to thwart this. This has actually been in place for a long time from in the early aughts. And so it was not designed specifically to stop this measure, although it had that effect. But I think what's also important to know about Florida is that the leaders of a lot of national anti-abortion groups are pointing to their win in Florida and saying, this shows that this is the model in that they convinced the governor to really aggressively oppose it using many levers of power. They launched lawsuits backed by the administration, the DeSantis administration. They launched investigations targeting leaders of the effort that people said were intimidating. They used taxpayer funds to promote messaging against the measure and just really, really pulled out all the stops. Even very routine sort of bureaucratic things that normally get no notice turned into huge fights over this. For example, the state is supposed to produce sort of a neutral assessment of what ballot measures would cost if they passed. So something like expanding Medicaid, it would cost the state X amount. So on this, they interfered in that process and put out a very anti-abortion statement about the predicted cost of the proposal, which said, you know, they didn't put a dollar figure on it, but they said that, you know, because it would, you know, lead to, you know, mass abortions, it would cost the state in litigation and in, you know, future tax revenues being lower because of all the children being aborted and not growing up becoming taxpayers. And so throughout the process,
really, let me back up on that. They were saying that this is going to cost the state because people who were aborted would not grow up and then contribute to the state through paying taxes and so forth.
Yes. And it is not the only state where again, usually a very just obscure bureaucratic process that nobody pays attention to and cares about, you know, was turned into a battleground over an abortion rights measure. This happens in other states, too.
Florida also threatened media outlets, television stations with criminal charges if they ran certain ads from pro-abortion rights groups. But what I've noticed, Alice, is that, you know, in many of these fights, it's become sort of less substantive as far as the anti-choice people go, less substantive and more bureaucratic, trying to keep the measures off the ballot in the first place, you know, messing with the way the measures are worded on the ballot. Like I said, the criminal threatening criminal charges, things like that. Am I right about that, that it's sort of the fight has become sort of more technocratic and legal rather than it is substantive, at least on the anti-choice side? And if so, what does that tell us about the evolution of the anti-choice movement in the post-Roe era?
Yeah, I think that is broadly correct. I mean, there were campaigns in all of these states that were just trying to convince voters to, you know, mounted by anti-abortion groups, trying to convince voters to reject these proposals. And so they weren't only using, you know, lawsuits and bureaucratic maneuvers. But if you look at where they succeeded, most of the success did not come through persuasion. It came through these, like you said, technocratic, you know, just pulling different levers of power. And so I think we are going to see more of that going forward. I will also mention that they succeeded in blocking a measure in Arkansas from making it to the ballot in the first place, which they attempted to do in many, many states, but were only successful in Arkansas. And so I think that's another example of this trend.
Now, in Nebraska, there were actually two competing reproductive rights measures on the ballot, one to restore access through fetal viability, the other to uphold the state's current 12-week ban. How did those play out in Nebraska?
Yeah, so a lot of people predicted that having two competing measures on the ballot would be very confusing to people, especially because there was the chance that both could have passed, and then whichever had gotten the more votes would have superseded the other.
Okay.
That didn't happen. People voted for the more restrictive one against the one that would have restored abortion access. But I think that is another sort of tool in the toolbox of the anti-abortion movement. Conservatives in Arizona had considered doing that. The legislature considered putting a competing measure on the ballot, but they couldn't agree on what that competing measure should entail, and sort of ran out the clock, and it didn't happen, and thus it passed. And so I think that, again, like in Florida, you're seeing the movement look at what worked in stopping these measures, and they're going to keep trying. But I will point out the number of states that have the ability to do a citizen-led ballot measure on abortion or anything else is dwindling. We're getting down to the last few.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've had so many over the past few years. And so not only are we getting down to the last few, but the last few are very, very conservative states where it is expected to be an uphill battle. Places like Idaho, places like Oklahoma, maybe trying again in Arkansas, maybe trying again in Florida. You know, this is not... You're not going to see the same, you know, this year you had 10 states. You're not going to see that in the future because there's just not 10 states left.
Do you expect that the states where it has passed, where it has been adopted successfully, that Anti-choice opponents will try again in those states to get another measure on the ballot that sort of does the opposite or at least limits what has already been passed?
Oh, certainly. You're already seeing, for instance, state lawmakers in Missouri vow to pursue that, to overturn this in the future. And I fully expect you're going to see legal challenges as well in many states. And, you know, there, even though Michigan's ballot measure passed 2 years ago, you're still seeing ongoing efforts to chip away at it, overturn it, undermine it. And so, I mean, I think these abortion rights battles are just never, ever going to be settled on either side. Neither side's going to throw in the towel and say, well, it is what it is.
Well, we finally lost. Oh, well.
These are deeply held beliefs that people are going to pursue to the bitter end
now,
on both sides.
Now, although the these measures did very well on Tuesday, they didn't win everywhere. But is there evidence that you're aware of, Alice, to date, to suggest that, you know, as Democrats had sort of hoped, that these ballot measures might not only shore up reproductive freedoms, but also sort of goose turnout in favor of Democrats? Do we see any signs of that? Do we know yet if that happened in places where these ballot measures were on the ballot this year?
So that was the great hope of many in the Democratic Party that pretty much flopped this week. And, you know, we had been reporting that Democratic confidence that the ballot measures would sort of automatically boost them, was that confidence was misplaced or inflated, because that's not what we've seen over the past 2 years. I would say this is like Michigan, where it really made a difference having that measure on the ballot in 2022, which, you know, seemed to have really helped Governor Gretchen Whitmer and Democrats take control of the state house. I think that we're now seeing was really an outlier. And in a lot of places, you had people vote on the very same ballot for these abortion rights measures and for candidates who are very openly anti-abortion. And that may seem contradictory to a lot of people, but I've talked to strategists on both sides, as well as abortion rights activists, who say, you know, in a way, these ballot measures give voters a permission structure, those were the words they used, to vote for Republicans, because they think to themselves, well, took care of the abortion rights issue. Now I can focus on other things.
Good Lord. Well, and it does give them permission to sort of vote for progressive things. For example, in Missouri, where they not only adopted this this abortion measure, this pro-abortion measure, I guess, but also a minimum wage and some other progressive issues. And then they turn around and they elect staunch anti-abortion candidates like Senator Josh Hawley, give him another 6 years, at the same time that they are approving the very progressive policies that Josh Hawley almost certainly opposes. Alice Solstein, many of the states where these measures were successful were actually ones where abortion access was already available, but where proponents, you know, sort of wanted to firm up that right by placing it into the state constitution, et cetera. You report, however, that some, like Colorado, aimed to make abortion more accessible by allowing state Medicaid funding of the procedure. Now, since Medicaid pulls from federal funding, you would something like that run afoul of the still in place Hyde Amendment, which bars the use of federal funds for abortions, to your knowledge?
It's a good question, but yes, that's why I specifically said state Medicaid funds, because Medicaid is a federal state partnership. And so, yes, this would not run afoul of Hyde. Several states already allow Medicaid funds to pay for abortions, just using state funding, not using federal funding where that is still illegal. But it is a fair question.
I see how they do that. Okay, that makes sense. Now, even if these rights are then enshrined into state constitutions, as we saw this week and as we've been seeing since Roe was overturned in 22, even if that happens and these get into the state constitutions under a Trump administration with a Republican Congress, they could, if they want, essentially overrule any of these measure, state constitutional measures, right, in all 50 states in sort of one fell swoop if they feel like it at the federal level.
That's right. And I think it's important for people to remember that it's completely possible for Donald Trump to keep his promise to not sign or to veto a federal ban that Congress may or may not pass, and for abortion still to be restricted at the federal level. That could happen through administrative rulemaking. Mm-hmm. That could happen through court rulings. There are lots of ways it could happen. So yes, you're right. And then that would override a lot of these protections that voters in different states have adopted. And that's what Democratic candidates campaigning in these states for the last many months tried to impart to voters, saying, you know, just passing a ballot initiative is not enough. It will not protect you in the event that there is GOP control at the federal level. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a lot of talk about a believability gap before the fall of Roe. You know, you had activists running around saying that this was imminent and people just didn't believe them until it actually happened. And now you're sort of seeing a similar phenomenon when it comes to the prospect of federal restrictions. People just don't see it as a threat.
Well, one more point before I let you go that also speaks to the believability gap, I think. You know, we've been talking to you for years on this show, Alice, about the GOP's various efforts on Capitol Hill to kill the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Well, a week or so ago, GOP House Speaker and Trump toady Mike Johnson suggested that Republicans were, in fact, preparing to take another run at killing Obamacare if they had the power to do so, even as that measure is now very popular. It affords about 50 million Americans health care coverage. I know these guys tend to overshoot when they take power, but is there evidence that they actually plan to take another run at what has become this very popular policy, even as Trump acknowledged during the campaign that he doesn't even have an actual plan after all of these years to replace the Affordable Care Act?
So it's one, we still don't know what could happen with control of the House, which will have a big impact on the prospects on this front. But I think, you know, for the last several years, Republicans have been telling me that, you know, a huge sweeping overhaul, you know, like they attempted in 2016, they aren't excited about that idea. They are more into chipping away. They think that's the best way to go. They think that is more conservative in the traditional sense of the word than, you know, some sort of giant repeal and replace effort. You pointed out there is not all consensus on any replacement or what that would look like. So where I would really watch and where I would encourage folks to keep an eye on is the Obamacare enhanced tax credits, the subsidies that make plans cheaper for millions of people. Those are set to expire. And so
really?
I think that is a place to look, because Republicans, you know, wouldn't even have to do anything. They would just have to let it happen.
Wow. Really? That, I mean, that's sort of that is in no small part sort of the heart of the Affordable Care Act, those enhanced tax credits that people use when they buy healthcare coverage on the exchanges. That they're talking about just letting those slip away.
That's right. And so there's already a big fight brewing over that. You have, you know, a lot of major players in the health space, the hospital lobby, and the, you know, many forces are already gearing up for this fight. And so that is where I would watch in the future, because, you know, they could tack additional policies onto that. They could horse trade and tell Democrats, okay, well, we'll give you these subsidies if you give us tax cuts or something. But you know, we often see that Congress only gets things done when there's a crisis and a deadline and a cliff. And
yikes.
So this is one of those.
And when is this cliff? When do we have to look forward to those tax credits ending, unless they're
next year? Next year. Yeah.
Oh, great. It'll be a great year. Looking forward to it. Alice Miranda Olstein, as always, appreciate your coverage. Appreciate you joining us here today. You can find her work, of course, at Politico.com, where she's a healthcare reporter for Politico Pro. And you can find her on the site still known as Twitter at Alice Olstein. Alice, great speaking with you. We'll be bothering you again soon, I suspect.
Thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you. You know, I forgot about, I think I knew, but I had forgotten about those enhanced tax credits under Obamacare coming up. They were, the bill was originally passed under what is called reconciliation.
Yes.
When you don't need a full 60 votes in the Senate to pass something to overcome the filibuster. But what that means is that these policies sunset. Usually, I think, 10 years.
Yes, they die after 10 years and they have to be reauthorized.
Right. That's why we had an assault rifle ban that was passed in the 90s. And then it came up 10 years later for renewal under George W. Bush. And he said, nah, even though, you know, mass shootings by assault rifles are down, we're just going to leave, let that ban expire.
Absolutely.
And it did. And so now we're looking at, you know, tens of millions of Americans who have health care, who can afford health care coverage thanks to those tax credits in Obamacare, who, you know, you might pay $60 a month, but in fact, your policy costs about $600 a month.
Or more.
Or more. But thanks to Obamacare and the tax credits, it only costs you $60 a month. That could end under Donald Trump and the Republicans, and they really don't have to do a thing to do it.
Absolutely true. That is what is at stake. Health insurance access for millions and millions of Americans, something like 50 million, I think, Americans get their insurance through Obamacare using those subsidies that help defray the exorbitant cost of health insurance every month, especially for people with children, you know, with families. And I think it, Alice, the way that she put it was that Republicans are probably going to just try to chip away at everything and then use horse trading to trade away not only, you know, women's rights to control their own bodies, but also to your ability, the average American family's ability to access and afford health insurance.
Or they just let it die. That's the thing. They don't even have to do a thing.
Sit back and watch it fade.
Well, now I'm starting to rethink my vote for Donald Trump this year.
Well, you know, with the House still out, the control of the House still out as we go to air, maybe that will be a bulwark to at least help stop that erosion.
Yeah, we will see. It's not looking necessarily great, but we will see once they count every vote, especially out here in California.
Absolutely. And, you know, you can help your representatives understand what you want them to do by calling them. They like it.
All right, let's take a quick break. We will come back with Desi Doyen and the Green News Report. You'll like that. That's straight ahead on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. My thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help Desi Doyen and I stay on your public airwaves. You're the only one that keeps us here. Thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
One more ballot initiative that I'm happy to report on before we get to today's GNR. Voters in Washington State on Tuesday upheld a groundbreaking law that is forcing companies to cut carbon emissions while raising billions of dollars for programs that include habitat restoration and preparing for climate change. Just 2 years after the law was passed, the Climate Commitment Act, one of the most progressive climate policies ever passed by state lawmakers, faced a repeal from, right-wingers and, of course, the fossil fuel industry.
Yep.
Wesley Daniels, who managed the campaign against the repeal effort, said in a written statement that the results on Tuesday demonstrate the power of a historic coalition and grassroots movement that came together to say no to more pollution and said they want to protect our clean air, water, land, and transportation investments.
Yay!
The law is a signature accomplishment of the outgoing Democratic Governor Jay Inslee, a longtime climate champion. It requires polluters to pay for the right to do so by buying allowances to, you know, pay for the right to pollute after decades of polluting for free and letting everyone else pay for the consequences of it. Each year, the number of allowances available for purchase drops, with the idea of forcing companies to find ways to cut their emissions.
Yeah, it nudges businesses to be cleaner.
The law aims to slash carbon emissions to almost half of 1990 levels by the year 2030, and apparently Washington State voters love it. It was blocked by the voters by 24 points on Tuesday. 62% no to just 28% yes. So good on you, Washington State. Those in favor of keeping the policy said that repealing it would not guarantee lower gas prices, but it would jeopardize billions of dollars in the state revenue for years to come. Many programs are already funded by the money that polluters pay, including investments in air quality, fish habitat, wildfire prevention and transportation.
And resiliency projects, very important.
Without the program, the Office of Financial Management estimated that nearly $4 billion would simply vanish from the state budget over the next 5 years. Yeah, but it would stay in the pockets of the oil and gas industry.
True.
So there's that. Anyway, it failed. Good. Washington State was the second to launch this type of program, not to brag, but second after California with stringent annual targets. So the state efforts, at least in some states, to save humanity and our planet, those continue even after, well, our latest green news report.
That will further embolden China to say that, well, if the U.S. is not going to pay respect in addressing climate change, then why should we?
Donald Trump's re-election has worldwide implications for climate action. Environment and climate groups vow to press forward. Plus,
Hurricane Rafael has made landfall in western Cuba as a Category 3 storm.
Hurricane Rafael knocks out Cuba's national grid again.
Again? Like the third time in 3 weeks, isn't it?
Yeah.
All of those grim stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
One Temple student tells us he went with a third party choice. And now that we know who our next president will be, he's reflecting on his decision.
I made my decision and I am now living with those consequences, and I will just hopefully see what happens in the future.
Well done, sir. I'm sure it'll be fine. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, before we get to the Donald Trump news, got anything cheerier like a deadly hurricane in Cuba and fires in California?
Well, funny you should ask.
Hilarious.
Hurricane Rafael rapidly intensified into a major Category 3 storm just hours before making landfall in Cuba on Wednesday, causing widespread flooding and collapsing the island's national power grid again, just weeks after several national blackouts. Rafael is weakening, but its track toward the U.S. now is quite uncertain. Fueled by unusually hot ocean waters, Rafael is an extremely rare November hurricane. In 170 years, only 10 hurricanes have turned in the Gulf of Mexico during November. Studies show man-made climate change driven by the burning of fossil fuels is boosting global ocean temperatures and triggering more frequent rapid intensification of storms. In Southern California, 10,000 people have been ordered to evacuate from two large wind-driven wildfires in communities north of Los Angeles that quickly destroyed dozens of homes and farm buildings. The National Weather Service warned of the risk of, quote, extreme and life-threatening blazes across the state due to fierce winds and extremely low humidity levels.
And quite a bit of drought out here.
Yes. In politics, voters in the United States on Tuesday re-elected climate denier Donald Trump as president of the United States, the first convicted felon to serve in the nation's highest office. Republicans also won control of the U.S. Senate. As we go to air, control of the U.S. House is still uncertain. Bloomberg News concludes that, quote, Trump's second term will have a dramatic impact on the planet, from the energy transition to curbing global warming, with sweeping implications for oil production, renewable energy, and electric vehicle manufacturing and sales.
And none of those implications good ones, I'm guessing.
Trump will also impact the U.S. economy and clean energy sector. He vows to scrap President Biden's manufacturing incentives for clean energy and electric vehicles, creating an opening for China to dominate the global clean energy race. Trump also promises a large-scale demolition of the federal government, gutting federal science agencies, and opening up the public's lands and and parks to drilling and mining development.
Great.
Trump's election has sent shockwaves around the climate world since he promises to withdraw the U.S. again from the International Paris Climate Agreement. Scientists say that Trump and Republicans' anti-clean energy, pro-fossil fuel agenda will increase U.S. emissions during the critical window before 2030 when scientists say emissions cuts must accelerate. Climate data firm Carbon Brief concludes that Trump's agenda will end any chance of keeping global temperatures below the 1.5 degrees Celsius target in the Paris Agreement. However, they also say that the global transition to cheaper renewable energy is unstoppable in other nations.
We'll see.
Bloomberg News reports that environmental groups, government officials, and diplomats have been working on Trump-proofing global cooperation and momentum on climate change, including working with U.S. state and local governments. U.S. environment and climate action groups have reacted to Trump's election with resolve to continue working toward progress in the states and the courts as they did during Trump's previous administration. Comedian Jon Stewart of The Daily Show echoed that resolve.
This is not the end, and we have to regroup, and we have to continue to fight and continue to work day in and day out to create the better society for our children, for this world, for this country that we know is possible.
For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Good question. Where do we go? I say wherever we go, it's forward.
Yes.
And what I'm saying is, not going back. That's what I'm saying.
That's true. That is it. And the fight now moves to the states to make things happen.
All right. My thanks to our guest today, Politico's Alice Miranda Olstein, our producer, Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's broadcast, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. Share it with your friends, your family, your neighbors, your enemies. That's at bradblog.com, and that is thanks to those of you who hit one of those donate buttons while you're there to help us stay on your public airwaves to hopefully inform the public in a way that too many media outlets do not. You know, like accurately and stuff that matters. Bradblog.com/donate will get you straight there. Drop me an email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, you'll find me at The Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world. Where do we go?